It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a proposed law in Wisconsin would limit social media access for kids. We'll hear from the state representative who's drafting that bill and from an expert in early childhood development. First, when you pay for a meal at a sit-down restaurant, we all know that a tip is generally recommended on top of the cost of the food. A lot of people will add like 20% plus or minus. What do you do when you pick up a to-go order at that same restaurant? At the register, they might have one of those touchscreens that asks you to choose a tip percentage and whether or not you want a receipt. Are you supposed to leave a tip if you're just picking up food and leaving? How about when you're grabbing a coffee or an ice cream cone or an Uber ride? The world of tipping has changed, and in the moment, it's easy to be confused about what to do. Call in now. We want to hear what you think or what you wonder about at 800-642-1234. How do you decide how much you're going to tip? How do you make the decision of whether to tip in any given circumstance? Have you encountered these touchscreen things that say, hey, here's a few different percentages you could choose? Do you like those or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Andrew Morio is an associate professor of hospitality management and director of research at Florida International University's Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management. He previously taught at the Culinary Institute of America and worked for over 20 years in the food service industry. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, now, I'm one of those people, I get confused in some situations, but you, with your background in academia and the restaurant industry, you're never confused, right, in those tipping moments?
I wish that was the case. COVID and these electronic devices have certainly changed the pressure to tip.
Let's talk about, the old days of tipping. We kind of all had a general idea that we were supposed to tip at a restaurant. How much did that factor into, how much money somebody makes working in a restaurant? How big a part of their salary was that?
Right. Well, so back in the day, as well as now, it actually very much depends on state to state. In some states, there is the tipped minimum wage, which is often around $2 an hour. So say, for instance, when I was a server in Delaware during my master's degree, I was making $2 an hour was the wage. And so pretty much that just went to pay my taxes. Most of my paychecks were nothing. And everything that I relied on was my tips. So this becomes a huge factor for a lot of service employees in the food and beverage industry.
Now, let's talk about some of these modern concerns. First of all, you mentioned the COVID era. People, I among them, started getting takeout from restaurants more than going to the restaurant itself. Obviously, that wasn't even an option at some point. How does that change the etiquette when we're doing takeout as opposed to sit down?
Yeah, I think there was a little bit of precedent for takeout. I've actually also worked as a pizza delivery driver, and there was a tradition in that field as well as to tip your drivers. So I think there was definitely some precedent for delivery. And then for takeout, for me personally, and I think for a lot of people, we recognize that during COVID, these employees were struggling and they were considered mandatory or essential workers. And so I think many of us tipped them even on takeouts and maybe tipped more than we would have during the pandemic because we knew that they were struggling and they were having some extra trouble. As we move out of the pandemic and into back to our new normal, I think a lot of those practices have shifted away from so much tipping on the takeout and back to more the dine-in time when you tip.
And I also mentioned this fairly new phenomenon. You pay with a credit card at the counter. It asks you in many places for your tip percentage, no tip, 8, 12, whatever it is. And of course, the employee who is or is not being tipped is standing right there. How does that change the way we handle our gratuities?
Yeah. I've known a couple companies that produce those devices, and part of their marketing is to tell employers that they will increase the amounts of tips that their employees receive. And so there may be, but again, I haven't seen any academic research on that. Mm-hmm. So I say that with that caveat, but I think having the person in front of you that you're supposed to be tipping and it already on the device in front of you, so you have to actively say, no, I don't want to, I think does add some added pressure to the consumer to do some sort of tip, to provide something.
One thing I've seen at a few places in recent years, including the nearest coffee shop to where I'm standing right now, is they put up signs saying, hey, we don't want tips anymore. We're going to bump up the prices a little bit. We're bumping up our wages a little bit. And then we're taking tips off the table. Is this rare or are you seeing this as a trend?
You know, this is not a new concept. I don't know if you're familiar with Danny Meyer out of New York City.
Is he the Shake Shack guy?
Yeah, he is the Shake Shack guy. But before that, that was his casual and QSR establishment. But he has many fine dining establishments like Union Square Cafe. And he tried to do this model in his restaurants where they increased prices and took away tips and told their customers they didn't have to tip. And even with someone as progressive as him, in the end, it didn't really work out so well. And I believe they did have to reverse their policies. So while this isn't a new concept, at restaurants, it doesn't seem to be taking hold. I think at a coffee shop, it could, because the price increase you're going to see isn't nearly as much as you would in a restaurant. At a coffee shop, you know, those employees, I think by and large, are not considered tipped employees. So they're at least making the full minimum wage and not the tipped minimum wage. And yes, I'm sure they do rely on some of those tips for their income. But in the end, they are making a bit of a better wage than what we would consider a tipped employee. I would applaud those establishments that are doing that. This is just my own personal bent. But, you know, the tipping culture can cause some problems between consumers and service providers.
We are talking about tipping and gratuities in the modern era with Andrew Morio, Associate Professor of Hospitality Management at Florida International University. He's got background in the restaurant industry as well. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Nick, hello.
Hi, I've got no problem tipping at all, but what really irritates me or offends me, I don't know how you'd say it, is these people that get on TikTok and entitlement, they're like, well, we don't get tipped enough. I mean, I even make my kids tip the dishwasher. That way they know that there's no job that's not worth anything. You know, every job is worth something. As long as you're getting paid, then you should get tipped. But
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. And David on Facebook, on the Ideas Network Facebook, seconds that. He says a tip is for going above and beyond the basic requirements for the job. They are not, David says, an entitlement. Andrew, there is this argument sometimes like, oh, no, a tip is supposed to be for something above and beyond. You're not necessarily entitled just for doing your basic job.
Right. And that comes down to the fundamental difference in opinion of what service providers are supposed to be providing. And my only issue with your Facebook commenter is in these places where they're only getting $2 an hour, then the assumption is that tip is part of their wage. It's really not extra for going above and beyond. It is what's expected, unfortunately, because they do rely on those tips for survival. So this is why I said I applaud the establishments that are trying to incorporate the tip into the actual price of the meal. This way, the service provider, the waiter, the server, is not relying on the expectation and, I guess, generosity of the consumer.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Nancy now in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I have a great deal of hostility about being expected to tip in any restaurant. I feel very much that this is a form of corporate welfare. Why should I be expected to pay part of their salary? This is the responsibility of the owner of the restaurant. If he has to mark up his food a great deal more, well, then he's going to get a different altogether class of customers, people who really can afford it and don't mind doing it. But I have great hostility about this. I'm tired of reading articles in the paper that restaurant owners have such a small percentage of gain from their endeavors. That's because food is so expensive and electricity is ever so much more expensive, et cetera, et cetera. I can feel my blood pressure going
right
up.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. Andrew, your thoughts on Nancy's thoughts on the economics at work here.
Right. And you know what, Nancy, I really appreciate your comments because it strikes to the heart of the matter. I think most people don't understand that in most restaurants, on average, across the country, when you go and spend $1 in a restaurant, it is only 5 to 10 cents of that dollar that goes to the bottom line. Everything else is eaten up by cost. So restaurateurs are very reticent to increase the wages they pay their employees because all they're seeing is that their little slim margins that they're taking home already are evaporating. This becomes especially true when you have supply chain issues and the cost of, like Nancy mentioned, the cost of electricity. I mean, let's not even talk about the cost of goods right now. Your cost of food is just astronomical and outrageous. So this goes to the idea that maybe we need to, the restaurateurs need to come up with a new business model. Because I do agree with Nancy that it's kind of a form of corporate welfare, but you know, we can look at this as the same thing in these large corporations that pay minimum wage and then expect their employees to go on government aid. It's something sort of similar. So the restaurateurs are stuck between a rock and a hard place. They want to keep their doors open, but they also need to make a profit. And so the balance is trying to figure out how to make that happen, especially when you have very cost-conscious consumers, and that's the market you're going for.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Nancy. We're talking to Andrew Morio, professor of hospitality management at Florida International University. We're looking at the new world of gratuities, when, where, how, and why we tip. Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work someplace where you receive tips, or have you? What are your thoughts on this? If you own a restaurant or other commonly tipped kind of business, love to hear your perspective. And as a tipper, are there situations where you're baffled as to what you're supposed to do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We pick up our conversation now with Andrew Morio, Associate Professor of Hospitality Management at Florida International University, longtime restaurant industry worker. He's with us today to help us sort through the modern cultural etiquette for tipping and gratuities. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mary is with us in Milwaukee. Mary, hello.
Hi there. I'm going to toss in that I strongly agree with your speaker's last 2 points, his responses to both of the last two callers. I really hope that not very many people take their frustration out about the situation that we're stuck with, the structure that we have for tip-based work. Don't take that out on the worker. You know, you just don't want to make a social statement at someone's expense who is already not necessarily the most financially empowered person. I just feel like if you can afford to go eat at a restaurant, you can afford to tip the server until our system changes. The comment I was going to make, though, is that the hair salon I go to has switched to no tips. The people who do the hairdressing are paid an hourly wage that's a good wage, and it relates to their experience and their specialties. And I am super happy to move to that system. I would rather know that for the hour that the hairdresser is going to work with me, she is receiving something that is an appropriate compensation for her skill.
And Mary, did the initial price tag go up when they made that switch? Like, you know, X service costs a little bit more than it used to?
Not really, because I tip like a grown-up.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Andrew, what do you think of that hair salon example?
I think it's a great example. You know, I think people are very afraid that if we roll tips into the price of the meal, that they're going to receive less than stellar service. And of course, this is a possibility. But I think what you're going to find is that as employees feel more secure, more financially secure, more taken care of by their employer, that care that they feel will translate into the care they provide to their customer. And so, yes, while you're going to have bad actors, you're going to have bad eggs here and there. Those will naturally weed themselves out by being let go over time. And so, you know, I think that in the end, if we could figure out a way to do away with the tipping culture, I think there's a lot of advantages to it. But I think it's a very long, hard road to even really think about that in this country.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Larry now in Janesville. Larry, hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you could talk about the law that was passed in the 1970s for waiters and waitresses to only get $2.35 an hour.
Larry, thanks a lot. Can you talk a little bit, Andrew, about, you were talking earlier about that two-tiered system, tipped wages, minimum wage versus everybody else. Can you talk about the origins of that distinction?
You know, actually, that's beyond what I know. I don't know the origins. Hmm. What I do know is that the way it works is that you have to, your tipped wages have to bring you up to the federal minimum wage. And if you do that, then everything is copacetic and you can keep that tipped minimum wage. Again, my problem with the whole thing is then you have people who have to manage all this cash. They end up having to pay taxes out of their tips, and maybe they don't know that they're supposed to do that or don't know how to do that properly. It's a very flawed system that allows for people to fall through the cracks and for people to end up making far less than they need to in order to survive and to provide for their families.
Thanks for that call, Larry. Mary Lou is with us in Milwaukee. Mary Lou, hi.
Hi, nice. Thanks for taking my call. Just returned from Rochester, Minnesota, stayed in a hotel that had a nice little coffee shop. Called down and ordered to pick up the food myself, went down to pick it up, came to the cash register to pay, and the person who packed up the food handed me a bag and said, "You know, you can tip." And my response was, "Here's a tip. Don't ever ask for a tip." And I left. So that's just my take, that they think it's their job to now tell me to tip.
And, Mary Lou, thanks for the call. Awkward interaction for Mary Lou there. Andrew, what do you think?
You know, it is unfortunate that there are people that will go to those lengths to get a tip. I would agree with what I think her name was Mary Lou. I would agree with her that if you have to ask for a tip, you're probably not going to get one and you may have just lost a customer. So in the service industry, it is all about providing the highest level of service that you can and hoping that you've done the job that the consumer expects so that they are interested in leaving you a tip. Now, especially in that circumstance, it's one thing to provide the option in a electronic tablet or something like that, where we talked about earlier, or even a tip jar. So everyone sees it. They know it's there. If they want to, they will. And if they don't want to, they won't. In my opinion, if I was the manager, I would be very upset with my employee that they had made that comment.
Thanks for the call. Talking to Andrew Morio from Florida International University about the new world of gratuities and tipping. Back to your calls now. Randy is with us in La Crosse. Randy, hi.
Hi. Yeah, thanks. I tip when I go to restaurants, but I always tip cash. If I'm going to a restaurant, I make sure I have some cash. Because some restaurants, and usually it's bigger ones, all of that tip doesn't always go to the wait staff. And I know about this from people that I've worked with who've told me that happens. And the fact that wait or service industry in general gets the short shrift of everything. And the owners of the businesses take most of the profit, which is how it works all across our country. And I think it's despicable.
Randy, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. To Randy's first point, Andrew, and some of our commenters on Facebook have said this too. They might pay with a credit card. They'll tip in cash because of that worry about tip skimming by the restaurant.
Right. So let me tell you this. It's highly illegal. Tips are to go to tipped employees, to hourly employees. Management is not supposed to take any cut of that period. Now, what is practice and is acceptable and is legal is tip pooling, where all the servers pool their tips and then divide it out at the end of the day. And what is also common practice is that as a server, you are to tip out other employees. So as a server, you have usually there's bussers, right? So they're responsible for water and clearing the table, but they don't get tips directly. You're supposed to tip them out a percentage. If you have a bar and a bartender, you're supposed to tip out your bartender. And then even some very progressive restaurants are now having servers tip out the kitchen staff, because I can speak from experience. A lot of times, yes, the kitchen staff will make more hourly wage than the wait staff. But in the end of the day, the wait staff will take home more overall pay because of the amount of tip they're getting, especially in a higher end restaurant. So that's part one. Part two, whether you do it in cash or credit card. When you do it on credit card, all of that tip is recorded. Now, the employees are supposed to report out all of the tips they get, whether they're cash or credit card. But if you leave it in cash, then they might not necessarily report all of it. And there are formulas for the minimum amount they have to report out to. So if I have cash, I leave cash and leave it up to the employees to figure out what they want to do with it. If you do put it on a card, yes, there is some chance the restaurant is going to skim. But if you have a suspicion the restaurant's skimming, you know, you might think about not dining there and take your dollars somewhere else.
Thanks for that call. And Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here.
That's Andrew Morio, Associate Professor of Hospitality Management, Director of Research at Florida International University's Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management. He's with us today for a look at gratuities and how tipping etiquette has changed over time. If you're wondering, I don't take tips. I think I legally can't take tips. Ethically, I certainly can't. Coming up after the news, a state representative tells us about a law that would limit social media access for anyone under the age of 18. Then a childhood development expert joins us for a look at the ways that social media affects our kids. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, how much do our personalities change over time? We'll find out about the latest research on the topic of identity and how it transforms over the years. Now, how can we best protect children from the worst aspects of social media? State Representative David Steffen is proposing legislation that would regulate social media access for everyone under the age of 18 in Wisconsin. The Republican representative's bill would impose an overnight digital curfew on social media for minors. It would require parental controls and full access to a child's account. It would also require age verification, as well as limit advertisers and strangers access to kids' information. Last month, Utah's governor became the first to sign into law a bill limiting how children can use social media. Wisconsin now joins other states like Arkansas, Texas, Ohio, New Jersey, and Louisiana that are considering similar laws. David Steffen is a Republican Assembly representative from Brown County. I talked to him yesterday about his bill. Before we get into the specifics of the law you're proposing, can you talk about the problems you're hoping to tackle with this new legislation?
Well, I have been hearing for some time from constituents, neighbors, schools about the issue of social media addiction and the issue that it's been having on our youth, in particular, teen girls. The level of anxiety, depression, sleep deprivation, and self-harm has absolutely skyrocketed in the last 15 years. And there's been a lot of studies that have directly correlated that to social media. So as a government, we have a certain responsibility to an extent for protecting our kids. And so I think it's time for Wisconsin to step in.
Talk us through, please, what kind of things would change if your legislation were to become law?
For any newer accounts, so accounts that are established 2019 or newer, there would be an age verification process established by the social media company. So whether that is a government ID, whether it's facial recognition, other consumer data, we would have to, for the first time for social media companies, have an age verification process so that we know who are the kids that Wisconsin kids that are on our program. The second element is to have parental controls and parental access. So every minor account would automatically include parental controls and parental access, full controls. The third is to ensure that there is a dial down on the direct advertising that occurs, that the aggressive marketing, as well as prohibiting stranger contact. Right now, individuals, complete strangers, are able to direct message our children on Facebook and all the other platforms, which is a problem. And the final thing is to establish a curfew. Between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. would be a sleep mode for social media accounts for our children.
And social media, the term covers a lot of ground. Could you give us a taste of what outlets would be covered under this law?
So all the big ones are the ones that you should be thinking of. So that would be Instagram, TikTok, Facebook. Those are some of the big ones. Obviously, that would be Snapchat. Those are the ones, the big ones that would be impacted by this. And so we need to start taking a first step at ensuring our children are safe on the social media platforms. Right now, they're not. It is the wild, wild electronic west. And our children have been targeted by drug trafficking, sex trafficking, and the abuse and addiction that's occurring on social media needs to finally be addressed.
And do you, in the legislation, name those providers by name? If I started a social media company tomorrow, I won't. But if I did, would that be covered under this law?
So you're touching on probably one of the most important parts is how do we properly capture the companies we're trying to as it relates to this legislation. So we are still tinkering with that definition to ensure it covers the big ones. But we also want to make sure that we are in no way stymieing innovation that is occurring in this space. So we're working on defining that to ensure the big guys are covered and that we are still protecting innovation and technology.
And one thing that sounds tricky to me anyway would be enforcement. How do you foresee these laws, if passed, being enforced?
Yeah. The good news is that for the first time, the state of Wisconsin and its Department of Consumer Protection would have responsibility for enforcement. So if a complaint is filed from a parent, from an account holder, to the state then has the authority to go and start imposing sanctions on those social media companies. Right now, if you have a problem with Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, who do you really go to? And by empowering the Department of Consumer Protection here in Wisconsin, we'll finally have a big player that can be on equal footing against the social media giants, and hopefully we'll get better compliance in that fashion.
People may have seen in the headlines the state of Utah signed, a similar piece of legislation into law. Do you have your eyes on what's going on in Utah?
So I had about 80% of my bill kind of designed. And then I saw that within the last 60 days that Utah passed theirs. And I took a lot of their ideas and have incorporated many of the provisions that were missing in mine are now going to be in this. One of the big differences is they have created a whole new level of liability that doesn't exist in mine because I think it goes a little too far. But the most important things are the parental control, the social media curfew, and ensuring that there is some opportunity and accountability as it relates to the direct targeting and stranger connections.
As we wrap up, Representative Stephan, what is your timeline for this legislation?
So this is the best part. For those who have a lot of questions and want to know how this impacts them, I'm expecting this to move very, very slow. In fact, that is my intention, is to spend the next 4 to 5 months gathering input from schools, parents, psychiatrists, psychologists. I want to get input on how to make this bill better. So a lot of this is going to be taking this on a bit of a roadshow around the state so that people can have an opportunity to give me their input. But by the end of this year, I'm hopeful we have it in place so that beginning in 2024, we have protections in place on social media for our children.
Representative Stephan, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was State Representative David Stephan from Brown County. He joined us to explain his proposed legislation that would limit social media access for minors and provide some new parental controls. Now let's look at what we know about social media's influence on kids, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What concerns do you have about the impact of social media on children? Do you think we need some kind of legislation at the state or federal level to limit kids' access? If you are a parent, how have you dealt with this? If you grew up with social media, what did you see as the pros and cons? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Heather Kerkorian is a professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, where she studies the effects of media on children's learning, play, and family interactions. Heather, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here again. Thank you.
We heard Representative Stefan there citing some concerns that I hear out there quite a bit that, hey, access, too much access to social media can lead to mental health problems, emotional problems for kids, anxiety, depression, and more. What do we know about the kind of impacts that social media use can have on kids?
Yeah, the research is really complex. A lot of these issues are sort of systemic and have a lot of complex roots. I think the if we look at the overall average effect across all kids, the research, the best research out there actually suggests very small effects, if any. What's I think is a bigger takeaway from the best research out there is that the effects vary widely from one child to the next. So if we look at an average effect, it might be very small, if at all. But if we look at individual kids, some kids might benefit a lot from social media, some might be harmed by social media, and most of them are not affected much, if any.
So for a parent who's hearing that, they might say, great, social media might be perfectly fine for my kid unless it's not. So as kids start to age into social media, what can parents think about to make sure the worst cases aren't happening to their kids?
It's a great question. Some of the advice I like comes from the American Academy of Pediatrics. And one thing I like about their advice about media use with kids is they say a lot of the things that are important for screen time are just important for parenting in general. So, for example, with our kids' real life interactions, we want to know where they're going and who they're with. That goes for online interactions too. What sites are they using? What social media platforms are they using? Who are they contacting? And what kinds of privacy settings do they have?
And I'm casting a very wide net here when I say children and kids, because I'm literally saying 0 to 18 here, guessing there's a lot of variation. Let's look at those younger kids who might be starting to use a computer or a family-owned tablet or other device in the household. They don't have their own equipment yet. What are the things you would want to see parents do for those early days of going online for whatever?
Yeah, so one of the important things with younger kids especially is to the extent possible, use media together. So if younger kids have accounts or have access to the internet, having it on a shared device that's in a public space in the home rather than the child's own bedroom is very helpful. Using media together, making sure parents have access to any accounts that kids have set up is helpful. And any way that parents can set it up so that the only people contacting younger kids online are people they already know in real life and that the parents approve of.
And then I'm guessing, given that every kid and every family is different, there's no one number we could say, but when it comes to a kid having access to a social media account that parents aren't sitting there with them and directly monitoring all the time, what are things to think about before letting that happen?
Yeah, so technically, some of the only policies we have say that kids should be 13 in order to use things like social media sites. But of course, that's really easy to circumvent. And we all know lots of kids are accessing these kinds of sites long before 13 years old. You're exactly right that it's individual. One of the most important things I think parents can think about is to know their child and what their child is likely to be able to handle in terms of responsibility. So I tend to err on the side of caution and start with really good guardrails and training wheels for these kinds of things, and then slowly open things up as children demonstrate more responsibility. One of the things to look for is their ability to kind of self-regulate. So if your child is able to self-regulate well, they can resist temptation and do the things they need to do, then they might be ready. But if they're the kind of kid who has trouble resisting temptation or doesn't have an easy time following rules about things like bedtime or avoiding snacks when they're not supposed to eat snacks and things like this, then they might need to wait a little bit so that they kind of develop those self-regulation skills.
We're talking to Heather Kerkorian, professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, looking at the effect social media use has on minors, getting some thoughts for parents on how to handle these issues at kids of different ages. This after some proposed legislation that would limit kids' social media use. We just heard about that. It's in the works. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how social media affects kids? How do you handle these issues in your own family? What were some of the steps you took or wish you took with your kids? If you are the kid or were the kid in this situation, what are your thoughts? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Heather Kerkorian, professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, where she studies the effects of media on children's learning, play, and family interactions, talking about a proposal in the Wisconsin legislature that would limit access to social media platforms for anyone under the age of 18, looking at wider issues of children's access to social media and how parents handle these issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Stan is with us in Watertown. Stan, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you for taking my call. I was a 90s kid. I connected to ask.com or search.com in 1996 to a dial-up internet connection, and I've been messed up ever since. I just wanted to say probably the best thing in the bill is that restricting strangers app and everything else is probably not feasible to happen or have anything good come from it. So just stranger danger bad. Have a good day.
Stan, thanks a lot for the call. Heather, that is something I think a lot of parents worry about. It is part of the legislation that we were talking about, concerns about strangers' access to kids and their information.
Yeah, for sure. That's a really common concern. The potentially good news is that concern around that kind of thing tends to be higher than actual incidents. So especially when we think about sexual predation or drug abuse, things like this, those kinds of things certainly do happen. They're probably not happening with the frequency we worry about them happening. But I think one of the other pieces of good news is virtually every platform already has privacy settings that are optional, so that if parents do want their kids to engage with others on social media, they can explore those personal privacy settings and turn on anything that prohibits strangers from reaching out.
Thanks for the call, Stan. Rocky joins us now in Ashland. Rocky, hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Rocky?
So listening to you talk about this proposed law, you know, I understand the concerns are keeping kids safe from, you know, predators and strangers and, you know, trying to prevent depression and suicide and all that from social media influences. But, you know, growing up as a queer adult, growing up as a queer kid, if my household hadn't been supportive, you know, maybe I would have turned to social media to find community and safety and people who would help me get to a safe home, you know, situation. So if we're preventing kids from making those connections, it's not going to prevent the suicide and depression. It might make them worse.
Interesting perspective, Rocky. Thank you so much for sharing that. Heather, what do you think the potential benefits Rocky brings up?
Yeah, I totally agree. And this is, I started out saying for some kids, it can be harmful. For others, it could be beneficial. Rocky's example is exactly what I have in mind when I say for some kids, it could be beneficial. So if you imagine one child is using social media too much and they feel lonely, then maybe reducing social media access might help. But if another child is using social media to try to reach out, find help, find community, then taking away social media could actually do more harm than good in that case. And we find from kids, for example, LGBTQ plus kids say, yeah, they sometimes encounter bullying and harmful content on the internet, but more kids actually say they encounter positive, supportive community on the internet. Same with students of color. Kids of color say, yeah, sometimes we encounter racist content or otherwise harmful content, but more kids actually say they encounter self-affirming content or positive images of their race.
Thanks a lot for the call, Rocky. Chris joins us now in Black River Falls. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I was listening to the representative speak there, and I am just appalled as a citizen that he would even attempt to bring this legislation. I feel it's political suicide. If you want to debate Section 230 of the Communications Code, we can certainly go to the Supreme Court with that. But otherwise, I think the lid is off Pandora's box here. a long time ago. So how do you, if you game this out, how do you propose to enforce this?
I gotcha. Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Now, Heather, I won't ask you to get into the nuances of Internet and First Amendment law, but that general idea, the Pandora's box has been opened, Chris thinks, and it's hard to close it. For a parent to hear that, that can be pretty alarming.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I encounter this a lot, too. I can talk about what parents might, mm-hmm. when you might give your kid a phone or when you might allow them to use social media. And inevitably, there's a parent in the audience that says, OK, for those of us who've already done it, mm-hmm. what do we do if we didn't do it the way you suggested? And so this is definitely a concern that some parents have. I agree around sort of First Amendment issues. I'm not an expert there, but certainly when we think about kids online or kids using social media, we can think about ways that parents or other caregivers might best minimize harmful content while allowing access to positive content.
Thanks for the call, Chris, at 800-642-1234. Talking about social media and kids with Heather Kerkorian from the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Heather, let's take that magical moment when a parent is getting ready to hand over that phone to the kid, knowing that's going to open some doors to the social media world, maybe stuff parents are worried about. Can you talk about the kind of conversations that should go into that before the phone is activated?
Yeah, so I think open communication is key, just like anything else with parenting. So establishing what are the expectations? How do we have kindness when we use social media? How do we avoid harmful content when we use media? And focusing on the sort of do's and do nots, whatever that might look like for a family. So that might be certain hours that social media can be used. It might be who gets to approve the people that kids are allowed to engage with on social media. So having those open conversations with kids early and often is really helpful. And also having parents learn as much as they can about those platforms. So one of the concerns for parents is that they might just not know as much as their kids do. So being informed yourself around what platforms your kids are using, what those privacy settings look like, and how to minimize harmful content can be really helpful.
And a big question I imagine parents will ask you from time to time is, I don't do social media at all. Or I know the Facebook, but I don't know what the kids are doing these days. Like that generation gap in knowledge, how can parents overcome that to be familiar with the platforms that their kids might be interested in?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of my favorite resources is commonsensemedia.org. They have a lot of free resources for parents, including fact sheets about different platforms. So you'll see TikTok in a nutshell or Instagram in a nutshell. So they'll talk about the most current, recent, popular platforms, and you then give parents a quick rundown, including how settings.
And then when it comes to research, at the outset, you said this is a complicated topic to research, the impact of social media on kids that covers a lot of ground. All kids are different. What kind of research are you hoping to see or maybe even do yourself that's going to give us some more insight on the impact?
Yeah, so two things I'd really like to see. One is a much better understanding about cause and effect. So right now we know about associations in the same point in time. What we don't know is whether and for whom social media is causing an outcome versus social media is the effect, sort of what kids are doing to try to get help, for example. And until we know that, we don't really know how to intervene to help kids. And then related point is, how do we identify kids most at risk of harm and intervene with those kids?
Heather, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Heather Kerkorian is a professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She joined us today for a look at social media and its impact on kids. Earlier, State Assembly Representative David Steffen joined the show for a look at new legislation that he's working on that would limit access to social media for kids. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this and maybe your experiences in your own family, how you tackle these issues, how you wish you'd tackle them, maybe your advice for other parents facing the same scenarios. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And let us know how this all impacted your own personal life and your own family. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a new ProPublica series raises questions about Supreme Court ethics and undisclosed major gifts to Justice Clarence Thomas. One of the investigative reporters joins the show to share their findings, and you can join in with your thoughts and questions. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. And by the way, you can join an ongoing conversation over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We talked today about tipping, gratuities, and how they are maybe different these days than they used to be. Share your thoughts as a tipper or tippee on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Calling all Kyles. If your first name is Kyle, you could help set a world record, but you'd have to travel to Texas to do it. As reported in the Dallas Morning News, the city of Kyle, Texas, that's near Austin, is trying to set a world record for the biggest gathering of people with the same first name. The city's called Kyle, Texas, so the first name they chose was a no-brainer. This is their fourth try. The event takes place at the first annual Kyle Fair, May 19th to 21st. Participating Kyles will get a Kyle Fair t-shirt. I think you have to pay your own way to get there, though. The current record that these Kyles are chasing, a get-together of 2,325 people named Ivan or Ivan in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Kyles of the world, unite. This is Central Time.